This is Free Thought Radio with co-host Stan Barker and Annie Laurie Gaylor. Irreverent views, news, music, and interviews.
Imagine there's no heaven. Choose if you try. No hell below us. Above us, only sky.
October. I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor, and welcome to Free Thought Radio.
And I'm Dan Barker, your friendly neighborhood atheist. This is the weekend of October 1st and 2nd, 2010. Free Thought Radio broadcasts in Madison, Wisconsin. And we're also airing in Atlanta, Anchorage, Grand Rapids, and Monterey, California. And of course, we're podcasting everywhere. Free Thought Radio is the weekly production of the Freedom From Religion Foundation. We're the nation's largest organization of atheists and agnostics. We work to keep religion and government separate, and we work to educate the public, you listeners, about the views of non-theists.
We have an important reminder. The 33rd annual FFRF convention is taking place at the end of this month on Halloween weekend at the Concourse Hotel in downtown Madison, Wisconsin. We open festivities at 3 p.m. on Friday, October 29th, and continue all day Saturday, followed by the Sunday morning membership and board meetings for those who are members of the Freedom From Religion Foundation.
And one of the big name speakers at our convention is going to give us a preview today. Her name is Linda Greenhouse. She's covered the Supreme Court for 30 years for the New York Times, and she's still keeping her hand in that issue, and she's now connected with Yale Law School.
Journalist Linda Greenhouse will be part of the Friday night opening, joining Ayan Hirsi Ali. We're also going to have a video welcome from Wisconsin's Lieutenant Governor Barbara Lawton. Ayan Hirsi Ali will follow Linda Greenhouse. She's, of course, the Somalian former Muslim that we had interviewed in the spring, under continual death threat because she criticized Muslim treatment of women. She's the author of the beautiful memoir, Infidel. She has a great new book. I'm almost finished reading, about one chapter left. It's very, very good, Nomad. And so she'll be signing books along with Linda Greenhouse.
And Infidel is one of my favorite books. And just announced, another speaker is Gent Uygur. Is that how you say his name?
I think so.
Uygur, U-Y-G-U-R. Gent Uygur. He's known as the Young Turk. He's often spotted on MSNBC, and this Young Turk is a huge podcast favorite, especially...
It's the only national podcast broadcast.
That's broadcast. After he was on Air America, so after Air America folded. He was raised Muslim, but Gent Uygur is a very out agnostic today.
And we have an interesting lineup of local talent as well. Many of you will remember Mike Konopacki, who cartooned for years for the Capital Times. And he has drawn a devastating artistic answer to the Texas Board of Education's recent decision to delete any references to history regarding the separation of church and state from their history standards. And he'll be showing us that it's a really beautiful work of art.
We also have two high school teachers who are faculty advisors at West High School right here in Madison, Wisconsin. They're advisors for a club that they call the most hated high school group in America, the West High Chapter of the Freedom From Religion Foundation. We had Kirk Meffert on Free Thought Radio before, and he'll be joined at the convention by the second faculty advisor and by some of the high school students.
And speaking of high school students, we'll have our Thomas Jefferson Student Activist winner, Eric Workman, here to tell his story about how he stopped illegal commencement prayers at his high school last spring.
And FFRF's two highly competent and hardworking staff attorneys, Rebecca Markert and Patrick Elliott, will speak at a legal panel at our convention, joined by Richard L. Bolton, who is litigating FFRF's big National Day of Prayer challenge, and other federal challenges for FFRF. So they'll give reports and you can ask them questions.
And there will be a cameo by Professor James F. Crow, who was recently on Free Thought Radio, for whom the UW-Madison's new Evolution Institute is named. Jim is 94, and he's a world-renowned evolutionary biologist and educator, a foundation member, who will be introduced by another Jim, Professor James Coors, who happens to be an officer of FFRF, and you've heard him also on Free Thought Radio.
Both of them were on Free Thought Radio. And there's lots more at the convention. The beautiful and funny Julia Sweeney will talk. She'll make us laugh, and she'll answer questions. Julia, you all know, is an alumna of Saturday Night Live, who turned what she calls her beautiful loss of faith story into the hilarious play and DVD called Letting Go of God.
And last but not least,
Dan,
you will be joined by your irreverent comrade in arms, Steve Benson, to put on your show, Tunes and Tunes. That's your tunes as a melody, joined by Steve's cartoons. And Steve created an uproar, of course, when he left the Mormon Church as the grandson of then-seated President Ezra Taft Benson and is an atheist.
This show that Steve and I put on is probably the hardest work either of us has ever done, putting the show together, but it's probably also the funnest work. It goes by in about an hour, and it represents actually a weeks of hard work, but it's a lot of fun to mix his cartoons with my music and
it's
a bunch
timely
of
timely commentary.
And I think most of the jokes are funny.
So you can sign up at FFRF.org, go to the outreach link at the top of our homepage, find the convention under there. And it tells you all about booking rooms at the Concourse Hotel here in Madison, Wisconsin.
Concourse, yeah.
They are going fast. You're supposed to make those reservations by October 6th. You have all the information you need at FFRF.org's website. And so, Dan, you were on the road last week. Tell us quickly how that went when you were interviewed. You were taped by 60 Minutes Australia in Los Angeles.
That's why I had to miss the show last week. It was a last-minute thing. The 60 Minutes of Australia is doing a story, investigative story, about the canonization in the middle of October, October 17th, of Australia's first saint. Her name is Mary MacKillop. And since I had debated the Archbishop of Sydney, Cardinal George Pell, back in March, they were interested in my take on that whole issue. And so we met in Los Angeles. I was just there. I flew across country for a half a day to meet with them for this interview. And it was really a lot of fun. They have done their homework. In fact, they were partly responsible for exposing Cardinal George Pell's involvement in the cover-up of some of the pedophilia scandals there in Australia.
So we don't know when that's going to run yet, huh?
Probably in a week or two, just before or at the canonization.
And we have a lot of news to cover before we get to our interview with the Supreme Court veteran reporter Linda Greenhouse.
But we'd be remiss not to comment on the Pope's comments on us atheists when he visited England and he caused an uproar there 2 weeks ago.
Even in our own lifetime, we can recall how Britain and her leaders stood against the Nazi tyranny that wished to eradicate God from society and denied our common humanity to many, especially to the Jews, who were thought unfit to live.
He's hard to understand there, but what you just heard Ratzinger say was this: even in our own lifetimes, we can recall how Britain and her leaders stood against a Nazi tyranny that wished to eradicate God from society and denied our common humanity to many, especially the Jews, who were thought unfit to live.
Well, Nazis did not wish to eradicate God from society. On the contrary, they wished to eradicate non-Christians from society. They wore Gott mit uns, God with us, that means, on their buckle belts. And this is the supreme irony. Adolf Hitler was born and died a Roman Catholic. He has never been excommunicated by the Roman Catholic Church. In Mein Kampf, he said what Jesus had started, he would finish. Talk about the big lie. It seems the Pope has adopted the technique of the Nazis.
In his speech in the UK warning against aggressive forms of secularism, the Pope also said, and we'll read this rather than play the audio, which is really hard to understand. Here's what the Pope said. As we reflect on the sobering lessons of atheist extremism of the 20th century, let us never forget how the exclusion of God, religion, and virtue from public life leads ultimately to a truncated vision of man and of society, and thus a reductive vision of a person and his destiny.
Okay, so what's a more insulting vision or limiting vision of society, saying that every knee shall bow, we are all sinners and worms who must submit to a supernatural force, or the free thought point of view that puts people and human rights over religious superstition and dogma? You know, who's extreme? Atheists and agnostics who believe in separation of church and state, or the Catholic hierarchy that seeks to ban all embryonic stem cell research worldwide, to ban all legal abortion and legal contraception worldwide, that seeks to ban civil rights and marriage equality worldwide.
And also, let's comment on one of the Roman Catholic candidates in this country who's garnering a lot of headlines and really maybe proving the old adage that any publicity may not be good publicity.
We are talking of none other than Christine O'Donnell running for Senate in Delaware.
I dabbled into witchcraft. I hung around people who were doing these things.
Having fun.
I'm not making this stuff up. I know what they told me they do.
Well, what they do?
I mean, one of my first dates with the witch was on a satanic altar, and I didn't know it. And I mean, there's little blood and stuff like that.
So she dabbled in witchcraft. What can we add to that? Except, let's play some more clips of famous comments made by the youthful Christine O'Donnell on Bill Maher's Politically Incorrect.
Evolution is a myth, and even Darwin himself.
Evolution is
yes.
A myth?
You know what?
Have you ever looked at a monkey?
Well, then why aren't monkeys still evolving into humans?
I think she's evidence of the fact that evolution still has a long way to go.
But we've saved the best for last, and here's Ms. O'Donnell. Here she is perfectly in line with the official teachings of the Roman Catholic Church, which has no shame in intruding and meddling into the most personal of actions.
The Bible says that lust in your heart is committing adultery. So you can't masturbate without lust. The reason that you don't tell them that masturbation is the answer to AIDS and all these other problems that come with sex outside of marriage is because, again, it is not addressing the issue. You're going to be pleasing each other. And if he already knows what pleases him and he can please himself, then why am I in the picture?
Well, I suppose Christine would be opposed to organ solos as well. But enough hilarity. Switching gears. We interviewed a member of FFRF's new Tulsa chapter last month about the new billboard that says atheism is okay in Oklahoma, which the chapter has put up right now in Tulsa.
Tonight, a billboard battle brewing on the Broken Arrow Expressway. An atheist group put one up 2 weeks ago, and now a company has countered with a billboard of its own. News on 6 reporter Chris Wright joins us live to explain. Chris?
Well, Jennifer, the Freedom From Religion Foundation admits its advertising here over my shoulder to draw attention. So far, it's working, and the group says it doesn't mind the controversy that comes with it. The billboard reads, "Atheism is okay in Oklahoma." But members of the group Freedom From Religion Foundation say that's not always the case, and that's why they chose to pay for the sign.
We want to let people know that they're not alone, that there are other people that are saying in this state, too, that we're, not everybody in Oklahoma is superstitious.
The billboard was put up next to the BA near 15th Street 2 weeks ago. Its location, though, was not the group's first choice. Its members initially approached Whistler Outdoor Advertising.
When you have 80, 100,000 people driving past those boards every day, they see the name on that sign. So we look at our core values. Does it match up with who we are? And can we put it up there and feel good about it?
Whistler decided it couldn't, and this week even opted to display a direct response to the atheism ad. Among the ads displayed on its 10 digital billboards are ones that read, "God is more than okay in Oklahoma, and why settle for okay? God promises more."
Some decisions you make because of what you believe, and this was one of those decisions that we thought was in the best interest of our business and our community and for us as individuals.
The Freedom From Religion Foundation says it has no problem with the dueling billboards.
They want to impose their belief system on me, whereas I don't want to impose anything that I believe on them.
And while he doesn't believe in God, Bill Dusenberry does subscribe to the belief that any publicity is good publicity.
Kid's going to say, "Daddy, what's an atheist?" And Daddy's, "Oh, those are really bad people you don't want anything to do with." But then the kid might go home and look it up.
Now, the sign here also references one of Oklahoma's original senators, Thomas Gore. Freedom from Religion says he was the first openly open atheist in U.S. history to serve in the Senate. Now, this billboard will remain up here on 15th Street for the next 2 weeks. Chris Wright, the News on 6 tonight.
I'm Dan Barker with Annie Laurie Gaylor for Free Thought Radio, reaching out on behalf of the Freedom from Religion Foundation to the unmasked masses. We'll be right back to talk about a fascinating new poll this past week showing that atheists and agnostics know a lot more about the Bible than believers.
Hi, my name is V Tran. I'm from Chicago, Illinois, and I'm on Free Thought Radio.
This is Free Thought Radio with your hosts, Dan Barker and Annie Laurie Gaylor.
When they speak of ghosts and devils, I try to keep my mouth shut. They believe in talking snakes, but they'll say I'm the one who's nuts. In this big wide country, there ought to be room for many other views. Is everybody crazy? I've got those free thinker blues. I'm Dan Barker with Annie Laurie Gaylor, and maybe today we have the free thinker blues. We'll talk about a survey about free thinkers. We're co-presidents of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, which not only broadcasts, but we also litigate and we publish. Free Thought Today, a newspaper, and we publish books. The first book the Freedom From Religion Foundation published, and still a big seller, is by Ruth Hermance Green. It's called The Born Again Skeptic's Guide to the Bible, which takes off where Thomas Paine's Age of Reason left off.
And that brings us to that big news of this week, revealed by the Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life, that finds that people who scored the highest on Pew's simple 32 questions about religion were atheists, agnostics, and two religious minorities, Jews and Mormons. These questions were on the Bible, Christianity, and other world religions, religious figures, and constitutional principles governing religion.
As we've always said, the Bible is the bestseller that nobody, at least few believers, ever read. But we can attest that our membership is biblically literate. Many of our members came to reject religion because they read the Bible, not just those palatable passages, but the entire Bible. Cover to cover, at least have studied its entire range of claims and teachings.
Now, I've read the Bible cover to cover. It didn't make me an atheist because I was already a third-generation freethinker, but it did freak me out because I didn't want that book dictating my life and interfering with women's rights. And it's why I wrote a book about Bible sexism with the idea of informing the modern generation of women about the dangers of biblical literalism and how important it is to keep religion out of government and keep their dogma off of our bodies.
And I know from experience, Annie Laurie, that you know much more about the Bible than the average pew sitter does. Your book is called Woe to the Women, The Bible Tells Me So, and that's also available from ffrf.org.
Along with Ruth Green's classic Born Again Skeptic.
And we just have a minute to include some of the Pew's findings. 53% of Protestants could not identify Martin Luther as the man who started the Protestant Reformation. 45% of Catholics didn't know that their church teaches that the consecrated bread and wine in communion are not merely symbols, but actually become the body and blood of Christ. 43% of Jews didn't know that Maimonides, one of the foremost rabbinical authorities and philosophers, was Jewish. The question about Maimonides was one that the fewest people answered correctly, but 51% knew that Joseph Smith was Mormon, and 82% knew that the Mother Teresa was Roman Catholic.
And is the Pope Catholic? And now people can go take our Bible quiz, right, Dan? We have one at ffrf.org and take the quiz. It's right at our homepage.
There's 50 questions. How much do you know about the Bible?
And you can also take a quiz on how much do you know about separation of church and state. But you can also look at our books because freethinkers are very literate about the Bible and about other holy books. That's why we're freethinkers.
I'm Dan Barker with Annie Laurie Gaylor for Freethought Radio. Coming up, a real treat, we'll talk with Linda Greenhouse, who won the Pulitzer Prize for her coverage of the Supreme Court for the New York Times. She's an expert on the Supreme Court. She has a new book. She'll be signing it for those who register at the Freedom From Religion Foundation's upcoming national convention at the end of October, right here in Madison, Wisconsin.
Find out more about Freethought Radio and the Freedom From Religion Foundation at ffrf.org. Ask for a sample issue of Freethought today and find out more about the Freedom From Religion Foundation at ffrf.org. Or phone 1-800-335-4021. This is Free Thought Radio.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor with Dan Barker for Free Thought Radio.
And our guest today, Linda Greenhouse, is on the phone with us. She is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist who covered the Supreme Court for the New York Times for 30 years. She started that in 1978. Did you realize that, Annie Laurie? That's the same year that the Freedom From Religion Foundation became a national group, too. So we are concurrent. She now teaches at Yale Law School. She's a graduate of Radcliffe College, Harvard, and holds a Master of Studies in Law degree from Yale. She's the author of a biography called Becoming Justice Blackmun, Harry Blackmun's Supreme Court Journey. That book came out in 2005. And just out is the new book, Before Roe v. Wade, Voices That Shaped the Abortion Debate Before the Supreme Court's Ruling, written by Linda Greenhouse and the co-author Reva B. Seed. Maybe she can tell us how to pronounce that name. So welcome to Free Thought Radio, Linda.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
We're greatly looking forward to finally meeting you at the end of the month because you're going to be at our annual convention here in Madison, Wisconsin.
That's right. I'm looking forward to it.
And well, I was looking at your book, Before Roe versus Wade, and much of it looked very familiar. A lot of it is documents, and so many of the people who were agitating either for or against abortion before the 1973 decision. And in your preface, you write that the book's purpose is to recapture a time that is rapidly fading from memory. Why is that so important?
Well, my strong sense is that we think about Roe against Wade, we think about the abortion issue through the lens, we see it through the lens of Roe against Wade, and it can be kind of a distorting lens because we sort of see everything frozen in place as it is now, with two sides that really have nothing very much to say to each other. So it's just interesting to go back to the early 1960s as the collection of documents in this book does, and see how the issue first entered the public space in the modern era, and how it came up as a public health issue, and it didn't find people really locked into one position or another, with the exception, I should say, of the institutional Catholic Church, which never had any doubt about where it stood on this. But even since we're speaking on Free Thought Radio, even other religious groups, it's very interesting. The National Association of Evangelicals, who today we would assume are just diehard, right-to-life people, back in the late 60s, early 70s, before the court ruled, when every religious denomination felt the need to take a position on abortion as the issue was heating up, the evangelicals took an official position that, well, it didn't, I'm far from embracing the cause of abortion reform, were open to at least some kind of modest reform measures along the lines that an establishment legal group, the American Law Institute, had recently proposed. So I just think it's very useful for people to realize that at one point in time, not so long ago, the issue was something that people could discuss. There was a fluidity to it. The lines hadn't hardened, and of course this raises a lot of questions about what happened. So that's part of our material that we try to tease out also.
Also, some of this material, I think you're pointing out that the abortion rights groups were usually focusing on the woman. You heard a lot about women and what happened to them, which is sort of almost locked out of the debate today. You know, why is that?
Well, yes. I mean, that's true and not true. I mean, one thing that's interesting is that the feminist movement was a little bit late coming to the abortion reform issue, actually, and that's something that's surprising in the book. The issue was first carried forward by doctors, public health doctors, and by lawyers at the sort of elite levels of the legal profession. And what women were really concerned about in the late 60s wasn't so much abortion, but it was equality of economic opportunity, equal access to jobs, equal access to education, getting rid of the sex-denominated help wanted ads, women wanted, men wanted,
I picketed on that.
Yeah, it was
at 14.
Real barrier to women entering the workforce. So it wasn't until the very edge of the 70s that Betty Friedan, having founded the National Organization for Women, addressed an abortion reform group that consisted mostly of male doctors and said, you know, we now recognize that for women to have the kind of economic freedom that we are seeking, we need to have control of our reproductive lives. And she said, your issue, speaking to the abortion reform doctors, your issue is now mine. And that was a kind of and we have that speech in the book.
Yeah,
and that was sort of a key moment. So then, you know, you ask the question, well, what happened to the women? I mean, one thing that's really striking is that the Supreme Court, in the decision itself in Roe against Wade, issued in January of 1973, women's voices are almost absent from that opinion. It's not really an opinion about women's rights, although we often assume that it is, and nobody goes back and reads it today, and you would read it. You could read it 10 times and, you know, hardly find women in it. It's really an opinion about the rights of doctors to practice medicine in the way that they saw fit and what they understood to be the interests of their female patients. And so it kind of got launched in a way that almost erased the women's voices from the argument.
Well, and there was a lot of criticism. There was a lot of feminist criticism of the decision, except that it was such a great thing to get over, you know, to get legal abortion in all of the states, because it was such a huge fight that I think, you know, there were very mixed feelings. I mean, of course, we were all very happy, delighted to have the decision. But when we got down to the small print, we realized, I think what you're saying, that if it had been couched a little differently, maybe we wouldn't be where we are today. Do you think it mattered?
I'm not actually very sure about that. I mean, the decision was certainly criticized in legal academia, which it's interesting to know was almost devoid of women at that time. There were hardly any women law professors, for instance, but the male law professors had a great deal of fun and spent a great deal of time bashing the opinion and bashing the court. So that's, you know, setting that aside. I mean, one thing that happened almost immediately is that state legislatures, instead of saluting the Supreme Court and saying, oh, yeah, okay, now we get it, instead started working very hard to find ways around Roe and ways that they could create obstacles to access to abortion, and sending these cases as kind of test cases back to the Supreme Court to see what types of trimming back on Roe the court would accept. And so that was the kind of dynamic that I think left a number of pro-choice women saying, you know, how stable is this? What did we really get from this that we can rely on going forward? And of course, that issue is as much open today as it was back in the 70s.
Do you think black men in the court in the decision were deliberately, like, avoiding giving credit to either side? They picked a middle ground. They picked the doctor medical ground rather than, you know, appearing to give too much credibility or credence to either of the warring factions?
Right, right. And I take it what you mean by that is also they don't really acknowledge the strength of the pro-life claims either. There's, even though it was a 7-2 opinion, and the two dissenters, Justice Rehnquist and Justice White, really don't dissent on the right-to-life grounds. It's really more of a kind of, this is judicial activism that we don't agree with. So whether the court deliberately was seeking a kind of a neutral ground, it would be presumptuous of me to say, because of course I don't know what was in the deep recesses of their mind. But what does strike me in looking at the court's behavior, I think they were responding to the voices that they could hear. Mm-hmm. I think although feminist claims and right to life claims were certainly put to the court in briefs, and our book includes excerpts of all the briefs that were filed to the court in Roe. I somehow think that the court saw these voices as rather marginal, and the voices of the medical profession sounded very
authoritative.
Authoritative, exactly. Well, that's the word I was looking for.
And it was an all-male court.
It was an all-male court, that's right.
And the women's movement was very strong, but we were still working really hard to get anywhere.
So. Well, that's true. And also, of course, the only Catholic on the court was Justice Brennan, and his position was one of pro-choice, and so
those were the days.
yeah, that's right. So, the court might not have realized the real depth of feeling on the other side. They may not have sort of interacted with Catholics in a way that would have given them fully to understand what was going on that side of the street, but it's certainly the case that there was a huge Catholic anti-abortion mobilization before the Supreme Court said a word. I mean, this was not backlash against the court. It was backlash, or you might almost say frontlash, against the legislative reforms and the reform talk that had been going on for 5 or 6 or 7 years before the court did anything.
Well, and I think you're going to talk a little bit about that at the upcoming FFRF convention. You mentioned being fascinated by finding these documents about the plans that the anti-abortion, especially the religious leaders, had.
Yeah, well, that's right. I mean, what's interesting is that, of course, the Catholics and the evangelical Protestants barely sat down at the same table in those days, and they didn't have much to do with each other. And abortion was sort of a Catholic issue. And I think that's one reason why the evangelicals were not particularly engaged by it. I mean, Jerry Falwell, for instance, didn't preach his first sermon against abortion until 1979, 6 years after Roe. But I think what happened, at least our understanding of the subsequent history, is that a big issue that maybe a lot of people forget about now was the Equal Rights Amendment. That at the same time that the court decided Roe, the ERA was out to the states for ratification. It needed ratification of 3/4 of the state legislatures, which, of course, as we know, it didn't get. And the ERA was a locus of very strong mobilization on the right, Phyllis Schlafly, for instance, around issues of, pro-family and traditional roles for women and this sort of thing. And so abortion became a kind of a bridging issue that joined the Catholics and the evangelicals in this sort of new right, quote, pro-family, unquote, coalition that helped the rise of Ronald Reagan and the moral majority and all this stuff that we remember from the early 80s. And I think that was, something that happened a good deal later than Roe. So it's very hard to kind of ascribe that precisely to the court, as many people do, I think a little bit too simplistically. It was a very carefully nurtured and, you might say, manipulated effort at party realignment that eventually succeeded, but it took a long time and a lot of work.
You're right, Linda. I remember as an evangelical minister back then thinking this was a Catholic issue, and that's what, we didn't care as much until much later. We have to take a break right now. I'm Dan Barker here with Annie Laurie Gaylor. We're speaking with Linda Greenhouse, author of the new book, Before Roe v. Wade, Voices That Shaped the Abortion Debate Before the Supreme Court's Ruling. We'll be right back.
Oh, hi. My name's Walt, and I'm from just east of Buffalo, New York. I'm on Free Thought Radio. Isn't that great?
The things that you're liable to read in the Bible, it ain't necessarily so. This is Free Thought Radio.
I'm Dan Barker with Annie Laurie Gaylor. For Free Thought Radio, we're talking with the renowned journalist, Linda Greenhouse. And she's very powerful, but no, she's not responsible for the greenhouse effect. She's an expert on the Supreme Court. She covered it for the New York Times for 30 years. She now has a new book out on Roe versus Wade, and joining her bio from 5 years ago on Justice Blackmun. Linda Greenhouse will be the opening speaker at our 33rd Annual Convention of the Freedom From Religion Foundation in Madison, Wisconsin, at the Concourse Hotel, Friday night, October 29th, and then the convention continues through Saturday, October 30th. And Linda will also be signing books after her talk.
Now, Linda, I wanted to talk about becoming Justice Blackmun briefly, but before we do that, what is your take on the state of separation of church and state at the Supreme Court level? How much in danger is it?
Well, I think some of the court's recent precedents are hanging by a thread. For instance, there's a case that's making its way back up to the court, the McCreary County case, which is one of what seems to be an endless supply of cases about religious symbols, religious monuments, in this case is the Ten Commandments, and can this Kentucky County Courthouse have the Ten Commandments on its wall if it's part of some bigger display that has the words to the Star Spangled Banner and the Magna Carta and a bunch of unrelated other documents? And the Supreme Court several years ago, before recent changes in the Rehnquist Court, had said no, that violates the Establishment Clause, and that opinion was affirmed, reaffirmed by a federal appeals court a few months ago, and the plaintiffs are bringing it back up to the court, and there's been some personnel changes on the court. That was a 5-4 decision the first time, and I can certainly envision it being a 5-4 decision the other way this time, so there's a lot of the tectonic plates are beginning to get pretty shaky, I think.
Yeah. Now, are you still going to hear arguments, or are you just taking a vacation from all that, you know, at the Supreme Court?
Well, no. I write a biweekly column for the Times website, and I teach about the Supreme Court at Yale Law School. So, no, I keep my hand
you
in.
You keep your hand in.
Pretty faithfully.
Well, I would think you would. It would be very hard not to go after covering it for 30 years. I mean, it's just so integral. So you don't really miss it because you're still doing it.
That is true. I am. I'm with it every day in spirit, if not physically there.
Now, tell us how you came to write Becoming Justice Blackmun, how you got your hands on some of this information that went into the book.
Well, Justice Blackmun gave all of his papers to the country. He gave them to the Library of Congress with the stipulation that they remain closed, but then open on the 5th anniversary of his death. And so his family, anticipating a big scramble on that day, you know, give me the files on Roe against Wade, give me this, give me that, let me in to the collection 2 months early so that somebody, and I was lucky enough that it was me,
wow,
could kind of look at it in peace and quiet. And I, from that experience, I did a series of articles for the Times, and that then grew into the book. But the papers are all there, a wonderful collection, kind of a window onto the Supreme Court in the last quarter of the 20th century in which he served. And anyone interested in the court in that period should just go take a look. It's quite a treat.
You must be a fast reader because that's like a 500,000 documents, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, I had to be very selective, and I just chose a few areas, obviously abortion being one of them and women's rights being another.
You tell the story of his incredibly important input on Roe versus Wade behind the scenes.
Yeah, well, he was chosen by Chief Justice Berger to be the one to write the opinion for the majority, and it was in some measure a collective effort, and not an easy one, but it's obvious from his the notes he wrote to himself and so on that he really didn't anticipate the big public reaction that there would be. I think to the majority at that time, they thought what they were doing was something that was common sense, and they thought everybody would just sort of, you know, maybe take a deep breath, but line up and go right along. And I think the court was quite surprised. The first speech that Justice Blackmun made out of town after Roe had come down, he was greeted by right-to-life pickets. And he was really surprised. For one thing, he didn't think that he himself personified the opinion. It had been the collective effort of seven justices, including several like himself who were appointed by Richard Nixon. Harry Blackmun was no, you know, radical Democrat. He was a sober conservative Midwesterner named to the court by Richard Nixon.
But he said, don't be too hard on me. I was his third choice, right?
Yeah. So the polarization over the issue was something that the court didn't really anticipate.
Well, I think we're out of time. It's been wonderful having a preview. We're speaking with Linda Greenhouse, a Supreme Court expert. Her new book is Before Roe versus Wade, Voices That Shaped the Abortion Debate, and Becoming Justice Blackmun, her previous bio, and she will be speaking at FFRF's annual convention at the end of the month. Thank you.
Thank you, Linda. We also want to thank our producer and our engineer, Brian Tarani, and our announcer, Buzz Kemper. Free Thought Radio is recorded in Madison, Wisconsin. Go to ffrf.org/radio to hear the show in archives or to sign up for the podcast.
Ask for more information at ffrf.org or phone 1-800-335-4021. Ask for a sample issue of our newspaper, Free Thought Today. Look up the information about our convention again at ffrf.org. And tune in next week for more rational radio and blasphemous broadcasting.
Free Thought Radio is a production of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, FFRF.org. Irreverent views, news, music, and interviews brought to you by Annie Laurie Gaylor and Dan Barker.
I hope someday you'll join us.